I was looking in my refrigerator today, actually, for some lunch, and then I happened to come across a bottle of vinegar, which made me think, what is the permissibility of us eating vinegar and including that in any of our recipes? And you'll ask, what is the question? Why wouldn't it be permissible? So we look at a pasuk in this week's Parsha, where the Torah tells us, Lo sishaktu es nafsho seichem, mikol hasheretz hasheretz ala aretz. We're not allowed to eat any insects, any of these small bugs that are found in our society, in our community. So the question was raised by Rabbi Avram Danzig, who's better known as Mechai Adam. He has a sefer referred to as Binas Adam, where he talks about many issues of kashrus. And there, he asks a question. Again, this is the end of the 1700s. And he says, what is the halacha that somebody told me, a choker echad, he says, a scientist told me that it came to his attention that in order for something to turn into vinegar, it has to then go through a process where the bacteria is going to ferment. Right, you're going to have alcohol that ferments and turns into vinegar. But how does that process begin? It's when the bacteria that is naturally inside of the wine joins together with the oxygen and it's there fermenting for long enough, it will turn into vinegar. So he says, this is a major problem. How do we explain how one is ever allowed to eat vinegar? After all, it is made, it is created with bacteria, which is a sheretz, which is something that is a non-kosher entity. So how am I ever allowed to have vinegar included in any of my recipes? That is the question that is asked by the Chachma Sadam and his Sefer Bina Sadam. He comes to a conclusion that the answer has to be that vinegar is permissible, and you cannot argue that it's not. How do we know that? Why is this assumption that vinegar is permissible? He brings a proof, because he says the Torah tells us by a Nazir that a Nazir is not allowed to consume chometz yayin. A Nazir is not allowed to have any vinegar. Not only is he forbidden from wine, he's also forbidden from vinegar. Why would the Torah have to specify that a Nazir is not allowed to drink vinegar if nobody in the Jewish community is allowed to have vinegar? Because vinegar is treif. So it must be that the working assumption is that vinegar is kosher. A Nazir who has abstained from certain kinds of food items is not allowed to have wine and is not allowed to have vinegar. But why is that assumption true? Why is it that vinegar is kosher? What's the understanding? And he explains that the reason why, he doesn't really get to it, but he says perhaps when you have a bacteria that's inside of the wine that then ferments and becomes into vinegar, so he says that's really something that's just in an embryonic stage. That's not really a beria. That's not called a sheretz. It's not really here. It didn't really create itself into being anything real. And therefore, he argues that that would not be something we need to be concerned about. He doesn't flesh out the point enough. I know what he's getting at, but he doesn't say it clearly. So you look about 100 years later in the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan was born 9 years after the Chayei Adam passed away. So the Aruch HaShulchan is in the late 1800s. He passed away in the early 1900s. So the Aruch HaShulchan raises the issue as well, and he says that somebody told me, if you look in a microscope, and you look at the wine under a microscope, you will be under the vinegar in a microscope, you will be able to see that there are some bugs in there. And he says, I don't know if it's true, but he says, this is what I've heard. Now, it's not like today, where we have such availability of science, and we can look anything up on the internet and find out what the reality is. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes, I once heard this from a scientist. This is what he told me. I don't know if it's true. But he says, I was told that the way to create vinegar is by having the bacteria inside of the wine. And then if you look at it under a careful microscope, you will be able to see these items inside of the wine. And he asks, what is the permissibility? And he explains the answer is as follows. That when you have something, Delo Asra HaTorah B'masha Ein Ha'ayin Shaletes Bo, the Torah only expects of us to be mindful of something that we can see. The Torah does not expect us to each have a microscope in our home that we're going to be able to look at something under a microscope and figure out what's beneath the surface of what the eye can allow us to see. That's not an expectation that is expected of anyone. After all, we have a concept that the Gemara tells us in a number of places. In Brachos, the Gemara has it in Kiddushin and in Yuma, that lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. We are human beings. God understands that we're human beings. He doesn't expect of us to live lives like angels. So he gave us eyes. Our eyes allow us to see a certain level of reality. Obviously, we know now with microscopes that there's a reality beneath the surface of what we can see with the naked eye, but we don't have to worry about that. And therefore, he says, this is a klal gadol. This is a overarching principle that we don't have to worry about that which we cannot see with the naked eye. And that is a very important klal. That is a very important principle that we need to be mindful of. So Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz is better known as the Teferis Yisrael. He lived around the same time as the Chayei Adam, and he writes that he heard something interesting. He says about 60 years ago, again, this is in the early 1800s, he says about 60 years ago, there was a story that somebody said that there was a fish, and we all know that in order for a fish to be considered kosher, it has to have a snapper, vikaskeses, it has to have fins and scales. So he says, usually, you can look at a fish and determine whether it has fins or scales. Somebody came to us and told us that there is a fish that has scales, but you can't see them with the naked eye. And when you look with a microscope, you will be able to see that this fish, in fact, has fins and scales. Now, most regular people that look at the fish assume that it's non-kosher. But if you happen to be a scientist who has these equipment available to them, you're able to see something that most people are not able to see, and therefore this fish should be deemed as kosher. And this was a major discussion at the time. Would we allow this fish to be eaten or perhaps not? And the Tiferes Yisrael says, how can you say that the fish should be allowed to be eaten? Although it's true when you look with a microscope, you will find something that most people are not able to see. But the way we determine kosher or non-kosher is by what we're able to see with the naked eye. And therefore, the same way that we would assume that vinegar is permissible because you cannot see the bacteria, so too we would assume in the opposite direction that the fish would not be a kosher fish, even though scientifically we know it has fins and scales. But since we're unable to see it with the naked eye and it requires an instrument to see that, that would be something that would not render it kosher. The Magen Avraham actually quotes from earlier Achronim, from the Mabit, what happens. I'm sure every year we see people who go around on Sukkot with their esrogim, and as they're looking to pick one out, they sit there with a loop, and they're looking carefully whether or not this has any kinds of blemishes. Would it be a problem? So the Magen Avraham quotes from the Mabit, would that be necessary? Is that something that we need to do? And the Magen Avraham writes unequivocally, the Mishnah Berurah writes the same thing, you don't have an obligation to do that. You check out your esrog. Obviously it says, ulakachtam lachem, which means you should have a perfect esrog, a perfect lulav, it should be beautiful, it should be nice, check it out, make sure that it's okay, but you have no obligation to go ahead and check with any kind of instrument other than your own eyes. And that would be something that we would not be required to do. So, someone took this 1,000 steps further than the discussion was originally intended for. So we have a discussion about esrog in the Magen Avraham, we have a discussion about vinegar in the Aruch HaShulchan, we have a discussion about the fish in the Tiferes Yisrael, but then there was a major chiddush that came to the attention of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now Rav Moshe writes that we know the Gemara tells us that there's a halacha l'Moshe miSinai, that the tefillin have to have a square bias. And a square means it has to be a perfect square. So the Gemara says, this is a halacha l'Moshe miSinai. We don't know exactly where it's learned from, but it's a tradition that we have. And so much so that the Shulchan Aruch says, it's le'ikuva. If a person comes into shul one day and sees that their tefillin is nicked in the corner and it's not a perfect square, you have to get it fixed. You can't leave it alone. So you have to be careful. Sometimes we bump into the wall with our tefillin shel rosh, or you bump into someone or something, and you have to be careful to make sure that it's still a perfect square. So my father often tells over the story that there was someone in his shir who was a dentist. And this dentist was used to making crowns on teeth and all kinds of implants and different things. And he has an eye that can see precision more than most people. When I look at something, it looks like a square to me. If I happen to be a dentist and I'm looking at people's teeth perfectly every single day, to me, I can spot anyone in the shul immediately and see whether or not their tefillin is an actual square. So the question is, do I have to be worried because I can see when somebody's tefillin are not a square, but to most of us it looks like a square. Rav Moshe says, of course you don't have to worry. We don't have to come with measurements every day and actually measure it whether or not it's perfect. If it looks square, it's square. If it doesn't look square, it's not square. So Rav Moshe says that would not be a problem at all, and we would not be required to use any instruments to check that out. There's an interesting chiddush actually in the Pischei Tshuva, where he writes that in the name of the Maharsham, he quotes that there was a tiny sefer that was printed with letters that you were not able to read unless you had a magnifying glass. So the question was, somebody used to carry this around as a kameya, as a some kind of good segula. So he wanted to know, when he goes into the men's room, does he have to take it out of his pocket? Obviously, you know, you're not allowed to bring svarim into the bathroom. So does he have to take this out? And the Maharsham said, no. If you can't read it, it's not considered a divrei Torah. If the only way to read it is by putting an instrument in the way, and that's the only way to access the information that's there, that's not called a sefer Torah at all. That's not called divrei Torah. It's not called a siddur. It's not called a chumash. It wouldn't be a problem. So what was the chiddush of Rav Moshe? The question that was asked to Rav Moshe was the following, a frightening question. If you follow this logic and you say, by an esrog, it's not a blemish if you have to use a microscope. And by vinegar, it's not a problem if you have to use a microscope. And by a fish, it's not a problem if you can only see the scales with a microscope. So he said, I have a good idea. A doctor called him up and said, every so often in the hospital, we look at a patient, and as far as we can see, the patient looks like they're no longer alive. Now, if we follow all the machines tell us that there's a lot going on inside of the body that we don't see with the naked eye. So he said, maybe we should be allowed to pull the plug when we have someone who to our vision looks like they're not alive. And the only determination that we have that they're alive is that a machine is indicating as such. So maybe we should take this idea further and say, the same way that microscopes don't tell us how to determine the halacha, maybe when it comes to life and death, we should make the same determination. And we should say that as long as most people who walk into the room would assume that this person is no longer alive, we should all make that assumption, even though the machinery tells us otherwise. Would that be a reasonable conclusion to come to based on all these sources? And Rav Moshe says, absolutely not. Even though it sounds like it's the same, but obviously it is not the same criteria that is necessary for life and death as we would use for any of these other categories of halacha either. And Rav Moshe says, although it sounds very nice, he says the way to determine whether or not someone is no longer alive is obviously going to follow a very different set of laws, a very different set of criteria than we would follow when it comes to any of these other halachas, as important as they are. The criteria for life and death is certainly going to be very, very different and cannot follow the rules that we would find by other areas of halacha.